I don't think your clients are unreasonable. I don't think they're overly demanding. I think you create that. I think you create a story in your head that says, I must respond immediately to every client demand. I'm going to say, I don't reckon you do.
Welcome to Upon Arrival, a show that uncovers stories and strategies that make up all the moving parts of business events tourism with me, Adelaine Ng. My guest, Donna McGeorge, may be talking about clients, but I think what she's sharing can easily apply to other relationships in our lives, including some family and friends. And all of that impacts on our ability to show up as professionals or people of value for those we care about most. If you've just stumbled on this episode, hello. This is part two of my conversation with productivity expert Donna McGeorge, who's been taking us through her framework for how we can get back an entire day from our week, every week, and we've been unpacking some of those concepts from her new book, The One Day Refund. So if you've been looking for answers for how to stop always being so busy and yet at times unproductive, stay tuned. Here's the rest of that conversation. I mean, you get into the brain science in your book and all of that as well. But ultimately, I think what will really help people is that formula that you have for reclaiming time. So if people are going, you know, last year didn't really work. I was in lockdown a lot, or, you know, I've not been commuting. So technically I should have had more time, but I somehow time just got away and I managed to fill it up and I seem to be busier than ever, but not exactly feeling like I've moved any of the big needles that I really need to move. So how do we start this process? I mean, does it start with that calculator and just blocking out your schedule, even though it seems as though every hour in your day is pretty much filled?
Look, I tell everyone to start at the end of the day. So if you're swamped, you're drowning, you're out of control, you're overwhelmed, you're at risk of failing at the important things, you don't even know where to start, I'm going to say protect the last hour of your day or half hour, whatever's possible in your busy world. And I'm going to say that's where it starts. So you do at least two or three things at the end of the day that your future self will thank you for. So it could be anything from, you know, tidying up your desk area, leaving a clean desk so that when you come in the next day, at least it's nice and tidy. It can be sending four or five emails at the end of the day that the answers will come through sometime tomorrow morning, which may help you. Now, I get that I'm not a huge fan of dumping your stuff on other people so that then they have crazy afternoons, but there are things that you can do in the afternoon. Now, this can be even things like, now that we're moving around the world a bit more again, what are you going to wear tomorrow? What meals are you going to have this week or tomorrow? If you're going in the car somewhere or getting public transport somewhere, what route are you going to take? And these are the kinds of decisions we can make late in the afternoon of the day before that then help the next day start off a bit more, I don't know, productive, calm, peaceful, rather than the craziness. So if I was using the example of school, you'd be saying to your kids in the afternoon, what's on tomorrow? Show me your calendar. Give me the notes out of the school bag that, you know, you've been given at school so that you've already got a plan if you need to rush out to Spotlight and buy foam balls to make planets if you need to. But it's what can I do this afternoon that will make tomorrow morning that bit better. That's where it starts, because if you feel the cycle, it's off the vicious cycle, right? Then the next morning starts a bit calmer. You got a bit more head space, thinking space, breathing space, etc. And you're able to make better decisions throughout the day. And that's what I think is the key to it.
Yeah. And I think what might be also helpful is to just set an alarm for that time to do that, because it's so easy to just be carried away with whatever task is on hand that you completely forget to do it. I guess the other thing that we were kind of trying to work around is our human nature, because work is kind of addictive for a lot of people. Filling up our time is kind of addictive. Being busy is addictive. And I mean, I'm trying to stop this, what I think is a bad habit in itself, which is, you know, to ask people, how are you doing? And when they say busy, I'm like, that's good. I'm like, that's not always good.
No, I think we should actually start shifting our thinking. So, you know, how's work? Busy is a pretty automated response. Now, if you can't be bothered saying anything else, great. If it's someone that you don't know very well and it's just being polite, all power to you. But I'd love all of us to be actually thinking, well, actually, how was my day? And I'd love you to replace the word busy with productive or unproductive, even if it's in your own head, because I think that's a better measure of what my day was and whether things are good or not. And, you know, you're absolutely right. My mother, who probably will never listen to this, so it's safe.
I won't tell.
She asks me all the time, so are you busy? Is work busy? Because I think she thinks that's a measure of success. And I have to tell her all the time, no, I'm actually not busy, but gee, I'm doing some great work at the moment. But I'm not flat out crazy, as in, you know, running around like a chook with my head cut off. And this, I don't know where it came from. It could be, you know, my mum's a boomer, so it could have come from her parents, this notion that busy equals good or busy equals success. And, you know, we've seen too many examples of people like Tim Ferriss that talk about the 4-hour work week and the followers of him, that their badge of honor is what's the most amount of, if I want to talk about money as being successful, but there's other measures, but for the moment, for the purpose of this conversation, what's the most amount of money I can make with the least amount of effort or work days or something like that? Can I build for myself a context where I work, you know, 4 hours if you want to go there, but 1 or 2 days a week and still generate income? Now, that whole movement is huge. Now, anyone that's in a 9-to-5 job right now is going, you're dreaming, I've got to do my, or more, even 9-to-5 jobs, a bit dreaming. But you may not be able to make that decision and make that call that you're only going to work 2 days a week, but you can make the call on your weekends and you can make the call around after hours. The Australian way of life is built on this notion of 8 hours work, 8 hours sleep, 8 hours play. That's what the Labor Day movement was all about. And yet here we are, most people working 10 to 12 hours and bleeding into their weekends. And I'm going to say that's the biggest opportunity, I think, for anyone that's listening right now who's absolutely swamped, is to go, whether it's a timer, whether it's blocking time in your calendar, but that's the call, that this year for you is the year of, you know, relaxing in my non-working hours, if that's the theme you want to take, because I think there's a real opportunity there for peeps.
Yeah, it's what quite amazed me is that Australia has this image of being really laid back. I mean, I'm a migrant, so I was told that, you know, Australians are all, you know, you'll just work shorter hours. You'll be going to the beach all the time. It's nothing like in Asia, where I'm from, where people work, you know, 14 hours a day. They come home 10 p.m. and they start all over again the next day and they work 6 days a week. And the statistics that you had in your book kind of shocked me a little, which is how much time people were spending in unused leave. It was just stunning. How many of us were not even taking lunch breaks? I mean, where did that come from? I mean, were we always a workaholic culture?
I just don't know. I wish I had the answer for that, because I don't know where it all started, but we've definitely become it. So just to give you the reverse side of this, I spent a couple of years living and working up in China, and I was working for a global organization. And one of the things I noticed was how sacrosanct lunchtime was, particularly in China. I was living in Shanghai. And at around 12 o'clock every day, the office would empty as all the local Chinese would go out and have their lunch. And then I later found out they would, you know, have something to eat, then go for a bit of a walk. And then quite often would come back and have a little nap. They'd pop their head down and have a little nap. And when I first saw that, I realized just how indoctrinated it had become, that you skip lunch, that you work through lunch. You know, I remember one time I used to do corporate training, and I used to make it my business when I had people for a day's training to make them have an hour for lunch. And I'd say, go out, go walk, go smell some roses. And I had one girl come back and say, I walked all the way through the city, I could not find any roses. And I was like, oh, honey, I wasn't asking you to work during your lunch break. That wasn't a homework assignment. Because I do think we work through lunch. We work. I was just, you know, the statistics that I found were just alarming at how much unpaid overtime we do. Now, to some extent, you know, there's an obligation to organizations here, because I do think sometimes they take advantage of the goodwill of their employees. Yeah. So if I'm willing to do the extra hour here or there, the organisation goes, oh, thanks. And in fact, they called it discretionary effort, which they sometimes think is I'll go the extra mile, but often that extra mile means I'm going to have to work longer hours. And I think there's some work to be done. So when you think about these numbers, it's staggering, really. I mean, if you think about 3.2 billion hours a year in unpaid overtime, that's a lot of hours. Wow. And that's a lot of hours organisations were able to leverage, if you want to kind of think of it a bit that way. We have over 134 million days of accrued leave, and 3.8 million Australians don't take lunch breaks, and then 7.4 million Australians don't get enough sleep. Now, I say it's all a combo. All of that tells a story of overworked, overwhelmed people.
Yeah. And I think that's global. Yeah, I was just thinking if we've just, you know, as humans, we've just shifted things around. I mean, we compared the Western culture versus the Eastern cultures. And I do remember, I mean, back in when I worked in Singapore and Malaysia, our lunch times would be an hour long, but we would go out. And I thought maybe that's to kind of factor in that we do spend a lot of time at work. And that's why, you know, that hour becomes social. And so maybe it's the approach that we take, and we all try to kind of make sense of it, but we kind of just do what everyone else does as well. And it's interesting also the culture of trying to arrive before your boss arrives at work and leaving 5 minutes after the boss leaves as well, which is all, you know, just building into some really kind of unhealthy relationships, I think.
It really is. I remember a long time ago, before I began my own business and practice, I did work in a very large global organization. And there was one guy who had, this is about 20 years ago, but he'd set up a screensaver on his computer so that when it wasn't in action, it would just have various shots of business-related applications. So it might have an email shot or a spreadsheet or a Word document. And he had a spare suit jacket and he'd leave it on the back of his chair so that he could come and go as he pleased, and anyone that walked past his office at any hour of the day would see this, would see look like he's working because the screen would change. Now, that's, in some respects, I applaud his creativity around that, but in others, what does it tell you about a culture where managers and leaders have an expectation that, you know, or even, look, is it the managers and leaders? It may not be that people have an expectation that you do get in before your boss and you go home after your boss, you know. So maybe that says something to leaders to say you've got to start setting a more positive example around our expectations. I mean, we saw it during the pandemic that there was a percentage of managers and leaders that struggled not being able to see and eyeball their people every day, right? Because, you know, if I can't see you, it means you're goofing off. And so there's just a mindset shift that I think needs to happen. And you mentioned trust earlier around, you know, delegation. Do I have people that I trust? And it's like, well, where does that start? Does it start with I'll trust you first and give you a crack?
Yeah.
Or do you have to prove and then I'll trust you? I mean, I think it's the former. You create trust by letting people have space and room, right?
Yeah, interesting. Is there a difference between how creative versus logical people approach productivity? Could this be more challenging for some personalities?
I don't know. I don't know what I consider myself. I think I'm both creative and logical. I was raised by a Navy dad, so we have a very logical, structured, orderly way of doing the world. And yet my mum was an artist, and so I think I've got a good dose of creativity from her. She's a watercolour painter. And so I don't know that it's an either or. I think what we have to do is just find methods that work for our own style. And so it works for me to structure my days in 2-hour chunks. So I protect the first 2 hours. So this is very logical. I protect the first 2 hours for my most intense thinking and the kind of work that does need my brain to be switched on. I protect the second 2 hours for other people who need my smarts. So my brain's still on, but I'm happy to share it out with others. I protect my third 2 hours for the mundane, routine, repetitive, easy peasy work to do because my brain isn't, everyone knows you have the after lunch lull, so my brain's not as switched on. And I protect my fourth 2 hours or the last part of the day to wrap up and look ahead and make sure I'm setting myself up for success. So that's a very logical way of thinking about that. But I also think there's still enough flexibility in that system for when I have creative moments, because that's what I think the protecting of the 15% is for, you know, something happens and I go, wow, I've got an idea. I want to execute that idea, or I get an idea for a blog and I've got space to make that sort of stuff happen as well.
Yeah, that 15% to me now, that, I mean, when you first talk about it, I'm like, okay, that sounds like a nice idea. And then when you really dig into it, there's really something to that. I mean, you talk about the example of Hugh Jackman when he was preparing for the role of Wolverine, and he had this aim of expending not more than 85% of his energy because he was, you know, giving himself room to be able to function optimally over the long production period. So I was like, yeah, and that's what I think singers do as well, because they conserve their energy. Some of them don't even talk to people before they have to get on stage. And then when they do, they really measure out, like they leave something in the tank so that when they need to belt out a note or they know that there's a particularly challenging section, they've got the gas for that. So I've actually not thought about productivity this way, and it's really interesting to me.
It's really important. It's what I refer to as adaptive capacity. So it means that, because if we're operating at 100%, we've got no room to move, right? Whereas as you're right, whether it's a singer or whether it's Hugh Jackman, you know, if I know I'm operating at 85, I've got room to adapt if I need to. Now, Olympian Carl Lewis for me is another great example of this, that he was always thought of as a slow starter and a strong finisher because he would always be behind everyone at the beginning of the race, but miles ahead at the end. And the truth is he ran at about 85% the whole time. And what made the difference for him was other people would come, you know, out of the blocks, going 100%, and they'd run out of steam. Whereas he would run it at 85%. And if he needed to, a bit like your singers, he had some energy to tap into if he had to surge. But this surge capacity is something that should only be used every now and then. So you're right, the singer who's preserved 15%, let's say, lung capacity, so she can hit that higher note or he can hit that higher note every now and then, not the whole time, right? And even Hugh Jackman giving himself some space so that if it was a hotter day on set or if maybe they had to reshoot several times, he has a little bit left in the tank to accommodate that and can still deliver a great result. And I don't think we do that enough. Just the average, you know, the non-singers, the non-athletes, the non-mega superstars, yeah. We all need that space because a lot of the time we're constantly using that surge capacity and it's just not sustainable. We need the rest to recover from that. We can do it every now and then, but we should be operating at that 85% more consistently.
Yeah,
to feel better, do better, and actually achieve more.
I think it's just a matter of us not having thought about these things before. I mean, this kind of information is sought out by top achieving performers because they need it in order to do what they do. But most of us don't even, I guess, know this stuff. We're not aware. So, but once the awareness comes, you know, we can do something about it and that can make a whole lot of difference moving from feeling overwhelmed to feeling a little bit more in control. But Donna, you're one of Australia's leading productivity experts. Can I ask how you ended up here? I mean, were you always more productive than the next person or was this an initial area of struggle for you?
I think, look, it could have helped having my dad be in the Navy and we were always very, very punctual. Dad's view on punctuality was from you get in the Navy, you get in trouble if you're late. But he always taught us that it was about being respectful. And I remember he always said to us, there's no excuse ever for being late, ever. And no matter how many times we threw excuses at him, he would always say, nah, still not an excuse. And I think that's because, yes, in the Navy, it's a long swim home if you're late, right, for the boat. And then at one point, point, I think it's when I was a working parent. So my husband and I both were full-time workers and we had a daughter. And I suddenly hit that point that a lot of people are at, was despite that I have a super supportive husband, there was lots of things that still fell on me and I had to manage both. And then just to top it all off, I decided I wanted to do some study as well. And I suddenly found myself with a lot on. And I began to use time blocking techniques. I began to use compartmentalization, that I do these things at this, you know, on these days. And I started to really think about it. And I remember one day I had a colleague at work say to me, "You never seem flustered. What's your secret?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I think it's because I compartmentalize so well." And I think that's where it probably started.
That is a great skill to have. I mean, I think I would love a little bit of that. Any advice for creating buffers and protecting it while dealing with clients? Because a lot of us are in the business space dealing with people who are clients, and sometimes it's the small number of clients, but they take up all of the time. So how do you create that buffer and protect it?
So I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Eleanor Roosevelt, I want to quote, and I'm going to get it completely wrong, but it's along the lines of you allow people to treat you the way you allow them. So they learn. And so if you're super responsive, you think you're being super responsive by replying to emails late at night, by reacting really quickly, by allowing their demands to drive the relationship, you're teaching them that. I also have clients. I've got very big, amazing, gorgeous, and I hope they're listening now as I tell the world that I love my clients, every single one of them. And they know that sometimes it can take up to 24 hours for me to respond, and that's okay, because it's kind of like, it's like the, you know, years ago I went to a doctor's surgery, and this particular doctor was amazing, like really good. I really loved her. It's just that I've moved away that I can't see her anymore. And she was pretty consistently late. And so I knew that if I had an 11 o'clock appointment, chances are I wouldn't get in till 11:45. But I knew that once I got in there, she would give me all the time I needed. And so I was so okay with that. I knew what to expect. That's just how she rolled. And so I think that when we teach people how, I'm not suggesting to everyone now be 45 minutes late for everything. I'm just more saying that I don't think your clients are unreasonable. I don't think they're overly demanding. I think you create that. I think you create a story in your head that says, I must respond immediately to every client demand. I'm going to say, I don't reckon you do. I reckon your clients, great, nice, understanding people. And if you say, I can't get back to you till tomorrow, or you don't get back to them, you know, for 24 hours, I still reckon they'll stay your clients. And if they don't, do you really want them as clients? I mean, you said before, sometimes they're the small amount. You know, the Pareto principle says that 80% of your income is coming from 20% of your clients, and 80% of your angst is also coming not from the same 20%, but from 20%. So we all know the clients that are the most difficult and the most demanding, but they're not necessarily the best client for us. So it's a good time to do a client audit, I reckon.
And a good time of the year to do that as well. How do you protect your time generally, though? You know, once you've carved out the 15%, when it's easy to end up at the end of the year looking a lot like the end of last year, how do we stop ourselves and say no? Because I reckon that's really hard to do.
It is absolutely hard to do this. The toughest thing you'll do is protect the time, because you'll feel the pull from the clients, you'll feel it from family, you'll feel it from any other obligations and relationships you have in your world. And so you need to make that commitment to yourself that I'm going to protect it. But the easy thing to do is to just give yourself space between the request and your response. So too often the request comes in, you know, can I book time with you, or can you do something for me at this time? And we see that time and we assume that time is free. It's not free time. That's the first mind shift you're going to have to say. I'm not free at that time. And then you're going to have to ask yourself, what are the consequences of that? But even better, ask them, look, I'm actually not free at that time. Is there any other time that we can do? Or tell them when you're free. But it's giving yourself the space rather than being that very reactive, they ask, you go yes. Now, for those of you who might be listening who are in big corporates and, you know, someone's trying to book a meeting and they want you involved and you've protected that time, it is okay to go back and say, I'm actually not free at that time. Is there any other time? And then if they say, I'm sorry, we've got 15 people and you're the only one that can't do that time, fine, right? Fine, I'll have to do it at that time. But I just think too often we just don't check. I'm just going to say, just check. That's the first thing, because we make the assumption that if it's someone more senior, someone more demanding, a client, something like that, we don't check. We make an assumption. I'm going to say, just check. And sometimes you might have to accommodate them. And I reckon you'll find, you'll be surprised by how many people go, sure, we'll do it Tuesday instead.
Yeah. I love all these tips. I think it's really challenging me in terms of how I'm going to do 2022. Just, I think with just even some minor tweaks, you can make a lot of big changes. It's like those hinges on the doors. They're tiny things, but they swing open big doors. So I'm really appreciating what you're sharing here. The book is a really easy read. Can I ask you, what are your favorite productivity tools?
I have a, well, it's one of my own, sorry, with being a bit self-serving. I have a little journal that I've created that I've, and by little, I mean, it goes for a whole year, so it's quite thick, but each page is carved out according to the first, second, third, fourth, 2 hours. And what happens is anytime I think of something I need to do, rather than just write a huge long list, because a lot of people love to-do lists and I'm all for them, instead of just adding to my already huge list, I immediately stick it in what's the right quadrant for me to do that. And so my very own tool is probably my favorite productivity tool.
And how can people access that? I mean, if they're being inspired by what you're sharing and, you know, are keen to try it out for themselves, is there somewhere where they can grab some ideas from what you've just shared?
Yeah, sure, sure. So it's www.theonedayrefund.com. There's a resources section that has a whole pile of tools that are in the book. Whether they buy the book or not, they can access the resources. And there's also, I have a DonnaMcGeorge.academy site where I run courses and things where they can access some of these, some of the free resources on there as well. And on the One Day Refund website, there's a shop where they can purchase the journal if they are so inclined. Another way, if you just wanted to get the template for working in the first, you know, in the first 2 hours kind of methodology, in the One Day Refund book, there is a free template in the back that has the whole layout around how you can lay your day out according to that framework.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Donna, this is your third book. It's an easy read to make it easy for people to do this. And I'll put links in the show notes for how people can find out more. But what will you write next?
Well, if you were noticing, we're going up in increments of time. So the first book was called The 25-Minute Meeting. The second was The First 2 Hours, so minute, then hours. And then this one's The 1 Day Refund. The next one is going to be called The Next 2 Weeks, which is around short-term planning for long-term results. But don't look for that one anytime soon. We'll get this one going first. But in the next 2 years, you'll see the next one come out.
Okay, well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. It'd be amazing to chat again when that one does come out. You know, we've loved everything that you've shared, and I think I'm a little bit more positive about 2022. I was feeling really quite, I think a lot of us get discouraged after repeated New Year resolutions that don't work, and then we just kind of stop doing New Year resolutions. But I think you've given us some realistic ideas in terms of how, you know, we can make some real changes this year. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me, Adelaine. I really enjoyed it.
And hey, thanks for listening. I hope you got something out of that conversation. And can I be honest with you? I'm getting a bunch of spam in my email or messages from people who want simply to sell me stuff that I'm not really interested in buying. I would instead love to get an email from a listener once in a while. If that's you, I would love to hear from you. Let me know if there was something you agreed with or didn't agree with in this episode. Or if we've identified the problem, but you didn't think the solutions would work for you. And tell me why. Email me at uponarrivalpodcast@gmail.com. That address is also in the show notes. Oh, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review this show if you like it. That would help other people find this show. I'll be back next week to uncover more stories and strategies for a successful future. Till then, cheers.